Chapter 17, The Enemy of the Church. During the 8 years that I had so far spent in the East, I'd had very little contact with Christianity or with Christians, nor was I particularly desirous of having contact with them. In Calcutta, I had taken a couple of monks belonging to the Ramakrishna Mission to hear Stanley Jones preach. In Muvattuputsa, I had made friends with two or three Indian Christians who were strongly drawn to Buddhism. In Rajgir, my teacher Kashyapji and I had discussed mysticism with a Roman Catholic priest who, on our departure, presented me with copies of Thomas Merton's Seven Story Mountain and Seeds of Contemplation. And that was about all. Now that I was living in Kalimpong, however, contact with Christianity and Christians was difficult to avoid. And to tell the truth, though I was not particularly desirous of having contact with them, I did not go out of my way to avoid it either. Christians of several different denominations were both numerous and ubiquitous in the little Himalayan township, and the external signs of their presence were, in fact, one of the first things that the visitor to Kalimpong noticed on crossing the municipal boundary. At Seventh Mile, the extensive buildings of the Roman Catholic Mission covered much of the hillside above the road. At Eighth Mile, on turning a bend, one saw the square grey tower of the Scottish Mission Church dominating the bazaar. While at Ninth Mile, just below the road, there squatted the comparatively modest premises of the Blind School, which, during the time that it was under the direction of the Honourable Mary Scott, might be described as freelance Presbyterian. Behind and above the square grey tower of the Scottish Mission Church, dominating both the tower itself and the saddleback on which the greater part of Kalimpong was situated, rose the thickly wooded heights of Dailo, which, more often than not, were half covered in cloud. Dailo was the abode of Dr. Graham's Holmes, the principal stronghold of Christianity in general, and Scottish Presbyterianism in particular, in the subdivision, though the Roman Catholic Mission, which had got off to a comparatively late start, was now running a good second in the Christian supremacist stakes. The Holmes, as the institution was known in Kalimpong, had been founded by Dr. Graham, a Scottish missionary and educator, who subsequently became moderator of the Church of Scotland. Originally, it had been called the St. Andrew's Colonial Holmes, having been renamed in honour of its founder after his death. Dr. Graham had founded the Holmes in order to remedy, as he thought, a definite social evil. The Darjeeling district, of which the Kalimpong subdivision formed a part, was full of tea estates. There were probably hundreds of them. In the days of the Raj, the managers and assistant managers of these tea estates were nearly always British. Many of them, in fact, were Scots. And of these British managers and assistant managers, the vast majority were bachelors, at least in the sense of being temporarily separated from their lawful spouses. Since they were bachelors, they naturally entered into liaisons with the younger and more attractive members of the Nepalese workforce, some of whom were very attractive indeed. And naturally, these women sooner or later gave birth to half-caste children. Usually the children were not acknowledged by their fathers and lived with their mothers in the coolie lines, where they grew up dirty and neglected, without education, and with no better prospect before them than that of becoming coolies on the estate in which they had been born and to which, in a sense, they belonged. In the course of his pastoral and missionary visits to the tea estates, Dr. Graham had noticed these children, some of whom indeed had inherited the light-coloured complexion and even the blue eyes of their unknown fathers, and the kind-hearted clergyman had eventually arranged to take some of the more obviously European of them back to Kalimpong with him. In so doing, he appears to have been actuated by two motives. One, no doubt, was purely humanitarian in character. He was distressed to see the sordid conditions in which the little half-caste boys and girls were living. The other motive was religious, even missionary. He could not bear to think that children of Christian, even Presbyterian fathers, should grow up in total ignorance of the gospel. The religion of their mothers did not, of course, matter. The result was the founding of the St. Andrew's Colonial Homes, afterwards known as Dr. Graham's Homes, where the unwanted offspring of the tea planters were decently clothed, housed and fed, where they were given an English education, and where, above all, they were brought up as devout members of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. At the time of my arrival in Kalimpong, the homes occupied some 300 acres of the wooded Dailo hillside, immediately above the Tapa Choringompa, and had in its care about 500 children of all ages. Among these children, there were not only the unwanted offspring of the tea planters, but also the second and third generation descendants of such offspring. As Mary Scott had told me, the system was self-perpetuating. As well as Anglo-Indian and even Indian Christian orphans and demi-orphans from as far away as Calcutta. The children were distributed, I believe according to age, among some 25 or 30 buildings and groups of buildings, each of which was in the charge of a house father and house mother, or in the case of the buildings occupied by the youngest children, of a house mother only. During the week, the children attended the home's own junior school, or the home's own senior school, as the case might be, and on Sundays they worshipped twice at the home's own church, a square building with a grey tower that dominated the homes in much the same way that the Scottish Mission Church dominated the Kalimpong Bazaar. The institution also had its own hospital, its own meeting hall, and its own playing fields, besides numerous other facilities, some of which it owed to the generosity either of the tea planters themselves or of the companies for which they worked. It even had its own shop and its own magazine. Thus, the 500 children and their 50 or 60 house fathers and house mothers, as well as the Holmes's 100 or more teachers, administrators and maintenance workers, all lived very much in a self-contained little world of their own. But though they lived in a world of their own, they and the institution to which they belonged did, at the same time, exert a certain amount of influence, especially religious influence, on the larger and less highly organised world of Kalimpong. Both the house fathers and house mothers and the teachers, as well as some of the administrators, doubled as part-time missionaries, and on most days of the week, four or five of them, either singly or in pairs, could be seen hastening along the high street, Bibles beneath their arms, and a look of determination on their faces, on their way to a personal testimony meeting. In the high and palmy days of the Raj, the Holmes and its representatives had done much more than just exert influence. They had practically ruled Kalimpong, especially during the heady period when the subdivisional officer, who of course was British, had been none other than the husband of one of Dr. Graham's daughters, so that that lady reigned as undisputed Queen of Kalimpong by virtue of her double title as daughter of the town's leading citizen and the wife of the head of the administration. To such an extent was Kalimpong in the grip of the missionaries, indeed, that when the local Buddhists invited a visiting Buddhist monk to deliver a lecture on Buddhism at the town hall, those champions of the gospel were able to prevail upon the subdivisional officer to issue an order prohibiting him from doing so. The monk in question was Bhikkhu Silachara, or J.F. McKechnie, the Scottish Buddhist, perhaps there was the rub, who had worked with Ananda Metteya in Burma at the beginning of the century, and whose translation of the first 50 discourses of the Majjhima Nikaya had been of such great help to me during my days in Muvattaputsa. Exactly when Silachara's visit to Kalimpong had taken place, and whether it had taken place during the reign of Dr. Graham's daughter and her consort, I was unable to discover. But a year or so after the collapse of Stepping Stones, and therewith the Nepali section of the magazine, I brought out a Nepali translation of the Scottish monk's Buddhism for the Beginner. In my preface to this publication, I described how he had been prohibited from speaking at the town hall, adding that it gave me great satisfaction to think that, through the medium of the little work now being brought out, he was at last able to give the people of Kalimpong, and indeed of the whole area, the message that he had been prevented from giving all those years ago. Great as was the satisfaction it gave me to think this, however, it gave me still greater satisfaction to think that, now that India was independent, I myself was free to speak on Buddhism, not only in Kalimpong, but anywhere in India, and that Christian missionaries no longer had the power to prevent the followers of other religions from giving public expression to their own beliefs. During the year or more that I had been at the Hermitage, I had, indeed, continued to lecture at the Town Hall and the Hillview Hotel, as well as deliver full moon day discourses at the Hermitage itself. That I was able to do this naturally gave no satisfaction whatever to the missionaries. In fact, it was a source of considerable dissatisfaction and disquiet to them, particularly to the Presbyterians. And I had little doubt that if they only had the power, they would have accorded me the same treatment that they had accorded Bhikkhu Silachara. Whenever they saw me coming along the high street, especially after the visit of the sacred relics, in which I had played a prominent part, they would clutch their Bibles more tightly and hurry past me with averted faces. Not all missionaries averted their faces, however. Even apart from Mary Scott, who was a brave woman, and in any case, I had called on her at the blind school, and she could hardly be uncivil. There were some missionaries who dared to look at me, and some who even dared to speak to me. One of the latter, indeed, not only dared to pay me a visit, but after we had talked for half an hour, actually invited me to his home for a meal. This unprecedented event had occurred while I was still at the Dharmodia Vihara, the courageous missionary in question being a young American Seventh-day Adventist who lived with his wife and two children about a mile down the road in a bungalow called Hegavus. Though I had always understood the Seventh-day Adventists to be fundamentalists, and therefore intolerant even of other Christians, not to speak of the followers of heathen religions, the young American missionary showed no sign of either intolerance or bigotry, and we were therefore able to have a quite amicable discussion on matters of religion. The discussion was all the more amicable in that we soon discovered there was common ground between us and concentrated on that rather than attempting to explore our differences, which in any case were sufficiently obvious. This common ground was vegetarianism and teetotalism, for the Seventh-day Adventists, I learned, abstained from meat, fish, and alcoholic liquors, and indeed from all stimulants, including tea and coffee. Thus, not only did the fact that we had common ground between us contribute to amicable discussion, but the fact that that common ground took the form of vegetarianism and teetotalism made it possible for my unusual visitor to invite me for a meal, which he could hardly have done had the Seventh-day Adventists been confirmed flesh-eaters. Even if he had invited me, I would probably have found it difficult to accept his invitation, knowing as I did the embarrassment that could result when my hosts discovered that I did not regard fish and prawns as vegetables. But on the present occasion, there was no such difficulty. Whatever other differences might separate us, I, the Buddhist monk, and he, the Seventh-day Adventist missionary, could at least eat together. And thus it was that a few days later I found myself at Hegavus, sitting down to an American-style vegetarian meal with my hospitable new acquaintance and his family. Though the meal did not include apple pie, the sight of the plump pink cheeks and healthy, well-fed bodies, and the sound of the twangy transatlantic vocables, made me feel that I had suddenly been transported to America, the more especially since the family's standard of living seemed to be 4 or 5 times higher than that of their middle-class Indian counterparts. Unfortunately, the acquaintanceship thus auspiciously begun did not continue. The young American missionary did not visit me again, nor did he invite me for another meal, and shortly before my own departure for Sarnath and higher ordination, he left Kalimpong. Before leaving, however, he must have told his 2 successors about me, for they attended 1 or 2 of the lectures I was then giving at the Hillview Hotel under the auspices of the Institute of Culture. The younger of the 2, who was likewise an American, did not remain long in the town, but his elderly Dutch colleague, Mr. Jansen, was to stay for a number of years and become the real founder of the Seventh-day Adventist mission in Kalimpong. But though he attended my lectures, Mr. Jansen did not speak to me, much less still invite me to his home for a meal. And it was not until the following year, when I moved from Burma Raja's guest bungalow to the Hermitage, that I had any further contact with the missionaries of Kalimpong. This time, my contact was not with Seventh-day Adventists, but with Roman Catholics, and not with an American, but with 2 or 3 Swiss and an Englishman. Whether I first visited them or they first visited me, I no longer recollect. Since the Roman Catholic mission was situated down at the 7th mile, and since the white-clad priests often went into the bazaar, as I myself sometimes did, we must have passed one another on the road. When this had happened a few times, we must have exchanged greetings or spoken. The Roman Catholics were, on the whole, more civil than the Presbyterians. And in the end, either I must have invited one of them to the Hermitage for a cup of tea, or they must have invited me to come and see their church, about which I had already heard from a number of people, and which was, in fact, one of the sights of the town. Whichever of us it was that took the initiative, there was a period of some 2 or 3 months during which I visited the mission, and one or another of the Swiss or the Englishman visited the Hermitage fairly regularly. The mission consisted of 2 parts. Immediately above the road stood St. Philomena's Convent and St. Philomena's School, as well as the nun's own church, a large and ornate Gothic building with, I believe, stained glass windows. Behind the convent and on a higher level stood St. Augustine's Priory and St. Augustine's School, which had their own separate entrance up a side road, though a flight of steps connected the 2 fiefdoms, between which I subsequently learned there was little love lost, the nuns particularly objecting to the priests and brothers playing football with the boys. On my first visit to the priory, there was, of course, no question of my visiting the convent, the nuns from which averted their faces from me quite as sedulously as did the Presbyterians. I was shown the school, the library, and the cheese factory, where the priests and brothers, who were French and German-speaking Augustinians, produced the excellent cheeses which were in such great demand among the European inhabitants of Kalimpong and Darjeeling, and which found a ready market even in faraway Calcutta. Above all, I was shown the church, of which the good fathers were justly proud. A low rectangular building with a turquoise-tiled roof. It had been constructed on the model of a Tibetan gompa in order to make Catholicism more culturally acceptable to the local people, or at least such of them as had a Tibetan Buddhist background. In decorating the interior, the same principle had been followed. Behind the altar there was a carved wooden panel depicting the Last Supper, Christ and the Apostles being represented with slightly Mongolian features and wearing the garb of Tibetan Buddhist monks, while on the floor in front of the table at which they were seated stood a teapot of characteristically Tibetan design. The carver of the panel, I was told, was a Lepcher Christian. There was also a life-size statue of St. Augustine of Hippo, though the artist had resisted the temptation to make the African saint look like a lepcher. When I had seen everything worth seeing, I was taken to the refectory for a cup of tea. Though it was 4 o'clock, the remains of lunch had not been cleared away, and half-eaten joints of meat and half-emptied bottles of wine still occupied the expanse of soiled white tablecloth. On my subsequent visits to the priory, I spent most of my time in the library, where the more open-minded among the priests and brothers joined me for long discussions on Buddhism, comparative religion, and mysticism. Sometimes I borrowed a book, usually one of the Christian classics. For their part, my interlocutors were soon paying regular visits to the Hermitage, where we continued our discussions and where I lent them books on Buddhism. In this way, I got to know them quite well, particularly the two or three Swiss and the Englishman, who was known as Brother Peter. Tall, well-built, pink-faced, fair-haired and blue-eyed, Brother Peter was the very model of the pleasant young Englishman, and I was not surprised when I found him down at Glengarry one day having tea with Mrs. Hamilton, who, as a staunch member of the Church of England, generally had no dealings with the Roman Catholic mission, except when buying cheeses, but with whom Brother Peter was evidently quite a favourite, to the extent that that strong-minded woman could be said to have favourites. In the course of one of his visits to the Hermitage, Brother Peter told me something of his religious history. Originally an Anglican, he had joined the Catholic Church only 5 or 6 years earlier and was thinking of entering the priesthood. From the interest he showed in Buddhism, however, and the eagerness with which he devoured books on the subject, I suspected that Brother Peter was still not settled in his views, and that in the same way that he had moved from Anglicism to Roman Catholicism, he might well move from Roman Catholicism to something else. Be that as it may, when I had been visiting the priory for 2 or 3 months, and the three Swiss and Brother Peter had been visiting me at the Hermitage for a similar period, my contact with the missionaries of Kalimpong was again interrupted. Brother Peter and his colleagues suddenly stopped coming to the Hermitage, and when I happened to meet any of them on the road, they returned my greeting with an air of embarrassment and constraint, and I realised that I was no longer welcome at the priory. 4 or 5 months later, I learned that Monseigneur, of whose existence I had hitherto been unaware, had forbidden the priests and brothers belonging to the mission to have anything more to do with me. As for Brother Peter, he had been transferred to another priory, and a year later I learned that he had left the Catholic Church. Long before news of these developments reached me, however, contact between myself and the missionaries of Kalimpong had been renewed, though only to a very limited extent. During the 2 years or more that had elapsed since the Chinese invasion of the Land of Snows, the number of Tibetans in Kalimpong had steadily increased as monks and laymen, aristocrats and traders sought refuge in India from the miseries of life under Chinese communist rule. As the number of Tibetans increased, so did the number of missionaries, as Christian missionary bodies around the world hastened to take advantage of the God-sent opportunity of converting the Tibetans, many of whom were known to have arrived in India with very limited resources, and who might reasonably be expected, therefore, to be open to the appeal of the gospel. Some of the new arrivals among the missionaries had spent many years in China, from which they had fled at the time of the victory of the Chinese Communist forces under Mao Zedong over the Kuomintang forces under Chiang Kai-shek, and the subsequent proclamation of the central government of the People's Republic of China. A few of the more heroic of them had indeed made the journey to India by the perilous overland route via Tibet and had arrived in Kalimpong not very far in advance of the Tibetan refugees themselves. The other new arrivals came mainly from England and America, though considerable reinforcements for the Scottish Presbyterian Church also arrived from the land of John Knox. Since these additions to the missionary body belonged to a number of different denominations, some of them apparently to no denomination at all, and since they all had their own ideas as to the best method of converting the heathen, many of them were not interested in cooperating with any of the existing missions, or even with one another. Some of them, therefore, came to be regarded by the other missionaries with suspicion and dislike, even with hostility, though not always for the same reasons. Of none of them was this more true than of Father Morse, who, so far as his fellow missionaries were concerned, was the most unpopular, not to say the best hated, man in Kalimpong, with the possible exception of myself. Father Morse was a Cowley father. That is to say, he belonged to the Society of St. John the Evangelist, the oldest Anglican community for men, and had spent many years as a medical missionary in China, where his work had lain mainly among those afflicted with leprosy. Lepers were, in fact, Father Morse's special interest, not to say his passion, and on his arrival from China, he had at once opened a leprosy clinic at Tenth Mile, in a small room on the ground floor of a squalid building that functioned as a kind of caravanserai for Tibetans of the lowest class, including prostitutes and criminals. In this room, Father Morse also lived, with a leper boy as his servant and assistant. Here he happily looked after his lepers and anyone else who needed his help, and here he received his visitors, some of whom came out of genuine interest in his work, and some simply out of curiosity. Those who came out of curiosity rarely came again, for, more often than not, they would be given tea in Father Morse's single chipped cup, and the cup would be conveyed to them by the leper boy in what remained of his hands. Father Morse was, in fact, utterly indifferent to all that concerned his own creature comforts, and did not bother overmuch, it seemed, about hygiene. Apart from the chipped cup and his medical equipment, he possessed little more than a tin plate and spoon, a rickety chair, a saucepan in which the leper boy boiled potatoes for him once a day, and the shabby black cassock he stood up in. When he literally did stand up in it, Father Morse was an impressive figure. An American by birth, he was quite a big man, with a full white beard that came halfway down his chest and made him look like a Father Christmas in mourning. Not that there was anything mournful about Father Morse, though, except when he put his hand into his pocket for some money to give to a beggar and found that there was nothing there for him to give. With his twinkling blue eyes, ruddy cheeks, warm smile, and gentle manners, the old man was in fact the very embodiment of cheerful asceticism, and Tibetans who happened to meet him on the road often sought his blessing as they would have sought that of an incarnate lama. One would have thought, therefore, that the other missionaries would have been glad to have Father Morse living on their doorstep, so to speak, but this was far from being the case. They did not want him living on their doorstep at all, or anywhere near it. For one thing, they objected to his not living in the same comfortable European or American style to which they themselves were accustomed to live. This was particularly true of the Presbyterians and members of other Protestant groups, who were fond of arguing that England and America were rich because God was pleased with them for being Christian, just as India and Tibet were poor because he was angry with them for being heathen. If one wanted to become rich, one should become a Christian. Goodness and riches were inseparable. Father Morse's way of life had the effect of completely undermining this line of argument, which some of the poorer and more simple-minded Hindus and Buddhists found quite appealing. The other missionaries also objected to Father Morse's living in a not very respectable part of the bazaar, among Tibetans of rather disreputable character. Above all, however, they objected to his refusal to convert anybody, for it was the old man's proud boast that in all his years of work as a medical missionary he had not converted a single person. To him, being a medical missionary did not mean doing little doctoring when one was not engaged in the more important task of preaching the gospel. Much less still did it mean giving medical treatment on a condition that the patient read a tract or listened to a sermon, or even allowed himself or herself to be baptized. Being a medical missionary meant preaching the gospel by ministering to the sick in the name of Christ and leaving the rest in the hands of God. And in any case, had not Christ himself said, "Inasmuch as ye did it unto the least of these, ye did it unto me." And was not this in itself a sufficient reason for ministering to the poor, the sick, and the afflicted? This attitude the other missionaries of Kalimpong were completely unable to understand. To them, being a missionary, whether medical or otherwise, meant converting people. And converting people meant baptizing them in the prescribed manner and adding their names to the list of, quote, souls won for Christ, unquote, that was sent each month to the parent body in Europe or America as proof that the kingdom was spreading and that further financial support was therefore urgently needed. Since Father Morse refused to convert anybody and even gloried in the fact, in the eyes of the other missionaries, he was not really a missionary at all, whatever good works he might perform. Nor was that all. Not only was Father Morse not really a missionary at all in the eyes of his fellow missionaries, but his refusal to convert people was seen by them as constituting a direct criticism of themselves and their own work. For if being a missionary did not mean converting people, then what were they all doing in Kalimpong? Their work was a waste of time, and their lives without meaning or value. Thus, without his intending any such thing, Father Morse's presence on the doorstep of the other missionaries had the effect of seriously undermining their confidence in themselves and what they were doing, even undermining their sense of identity, with the result that instead of considering seriously the questions that his presence among them raised, they sneered at him, spoke disparagingly about him, avoided contact with him, and in short, in the case of the Presbyterians in particular, averted their faces from him, both literally and metaphorically, quite as much as they did from me. To such an extent did the missionaries of Kalimpong, and the Presbyterians in particular, avert their faces from Father Morse, that they refused to have anything to do with him, even at that season of the year, which was, supposedly, the season of peace on earth and goodwill towards men. Happening to look in at Father Morse's leprosy clinic on Christmas Eve, Joe found the old man almost in tears. "Tomorrow was Christmas Day," he explained, "but he had no food for the occasion and no money to buy any." Not that he really minded that. What hurt him was the fact that none of the missionaries had cared to invite him to have his Christmas dinner with them, even though they knew that he would be on his own, while they themselves would be sitting down to a sumptuous repast with their families. A little hesitantly, Joe suggested a solution to the problem. "I'm a Buddhist," he said, "but if you care to come to my place tomorrow, I should be glad to give you your Christmas dinner." Father Morse brightened up immediately. "Oh, would you, Joe?" he cried eagerly. "I should love to come." The result was that the next day Father Morse went to Joe's flat, where he was given a Christmas dinner consisting of roast chicken — Joe was not a vegetarian — potatoes and peas, all of which he very much enjoyed, and for all of which, no doubt, he gave heartfelt thanks to his God. What would have happened if Father Morse had been in Kalimpong the following Christmas, there is no knowing, but before he had been in the town a year, his religious superiors, for whose instructions he had been waiting, recalled him to the United States. Since he had been hoping to be allowed to remain in Kalimpong among his beloved lepers, the summons came as a great disappointment, but to him the voice of his religious superiors was the voice of God, and he therefore obeyed it unquestioningly, though with obvious reluctance. And after saying his farewells, sadly left for America, where there were no lepers for him to look after. But though his stay in Kalimpong had been comparatively short, Father Morse was remembered for a long time afterwards, and though the other missionaries might not have cared to mention him, his name was pronounced in accents of affection and gratitude by many a Tibetan and many a Nepali, until time and distance eventually transformed the old medical missionary into an almost legendary figure whose benign presence had for a while shed a ray of light on some of the darkest places of the town. A medical missionary of a very different type, whose presence shed no ray of light on the dark places of Kalimpong, and who was certainly not remembered in the way that Father Morse was remembered, was a bumptious, red-bearded young Scotsman on whom Joe, in a moment of inspiration, bestowed the sobriquet of Springheel Jack. Springheel Jack had appeared in Kalimpong at about the same time as Father Morse, and thereafter reappeared at intervals for several years. Like Father Morse, he had come from China, and had in fact travelled to India by the overland route via Tibet. While in Tibet, he had spent some time among the Khambas, for whom he had developed a great affection, the more especially since they were engaged in an armed struggle against the Chinese communist forces, which had recently invaded their homeland in eastern Tibet. He had not, however, developed an affection for the Khambas religion. To him, Tibetan Buddhism was a species of demonolatry, and its rites and ceremonies a form of black magic. Probably it was for this reason that he always gave me a wide berth, and we never actually met. Father Morse had visited me at the Hermitage several times. Though I saw him spring-heeling his way around the bazaar often enough, blue eyes fiercely blazing, and the familiar black Bible tucked beneath his arm like a Sten gun, ready to spray anybody who crossed his path with texts. According to Joe, he had originally belonged to the Plymouth Brethren, but had left them because they were too liberal-minded, and was now a freelance preacher of the gospel, owing no allegiance to any religious organisation, and taking his orders direct from God. To do him justice, however, he spent very little time actually preaching, being mainly occupied either playing tennis or plotting against the Chinese communists with his Khamba friends. If Springheel Jack gave me a wide berth, the missionary girls, perhaps less wisely, made a beeline for me. From what I subsequently heard about the two young English women thus denominated, they were evangelical, eager beavers who, after spending 2 years at a Bible college in the West Country, had come out to Kalimpong full of the joy of the Lord and determined to do battle with the forces of evil and convert the heathen inhabitants of the town to Christianity. On their alighting from the Land Rover that had brought them up from Siliguri, however, almost the first person they set eyes on was a European who had evidently been converted from Christianity to a heathen religion, namely myself in my yellow robes. This was a terrible shock to them, since not in their worst moments had they imagined that there could be such a thing as a European Buddhist, least of all an English Buddhist. Undaunted, nevertheless, after much searching of the scriptures and much waiting on the Lord in prayer, they sent word that they would like to meet me, and I responded by inviting them to tea, and at 4 o'clock on the appointed day, with their Bibles under their arms and rather fixed smiles on their faces, they accordingly ascended the steps of the chalet, where I had caused Ang Tsering to lay on a nice tea for them, complete with colourfully iced little cakes from our itinerant roti walla, or breadman. The minute I set eyes on the ill-assorted pair, I mentally christened them Miss Long and Miss Short, and though subsequently I learnt to speak of them as the missionary girls, as everybody else in Kalimpong did, It was as Miss Long and Miss Short that I continued to think of them for a long time afterwards. Miss Long was tall and thin, with a pale face and a thoughtful, even worried expression. Miss Short, on the other hand, was of diminutive stature and decidedly plump, with round red cheeks and an expression of great cheerfulness, not to say heartiness. Both women had brown hair, straight in the case of Miss Long and curly in the case of Miss Short, and both were about the same age as myself, that is to say, not more than 27 or 28. As soon as we had exchanged greetings, they had taken their seats with me round the little table by the window at which I did my writing. Ang Tsering entered with the teapot held shoulder high in Tibetan fashion, and for the next 10 or 15 minutes I endeavoured to put my visitors at ease with a combination of small talk, cups of Darjeeling tea, and colourfully iced little cakes. But though Miss Long and Miss Short each drank 2 cups of tea, they only nibbled at the pink, mauve and green cakes, and I realised that they would not really be satisfied or at ease until they had actually done battle with the forces of evil, as represented by the yellow-robed figure on the other side of the table. I also realised that the reason they only nibbled at the cakes was that they suspected me of having muttered evil charms over them. Spring-Heeled Jack and many of the other missionaries firmly believed that Buddhist monks were expert black magicians and often did that sort of thing. When Ang Tsering had cleared the table, I therefore gave them the opportunity for which they had, no doubt, been waiting, by inquiring what had brought them to Kaimpong and why they wanted to meet me, though the fact that they had their Bibles open on their laps in readiness really made the question unnecessary. My visitors needed no further encouragement, and soon the bullets were flying thick and fast, as now Miss Long and now Miss Short directed her firepower upon me, or as, to speak less metaphorically, they between them treated me to the kind of text-citing evangelical spiel that might have been expected from 2 enthusiastic young women, both unmarried, who had just spent 2 years at Bible college, and who possessed more zeal than discretion, and no consciousness whatever of their limitations, even as exponents of their own faith. I made no attempt to interrupt them, much less still to argue with them, though in their eagerness to convert me, they frequently interrupted each other, and occasionally even disagreed on minor points. When they had finished, or at least they were left with nothing more to say for the time being, I told them that while I had no wish to question the genuineness of their experience, for in the course of their joint harangue they had given their personal testimony concerning the wonderful things that Jesus had done for them, I had no wish either to question the genuineness of the experience of the followers of other religions. Jesus had, no doubt, done wonderful things for them, but devout Hindus said the same thing of Rama and Krishna, and pious Muslims of Muhammad. Speaking personally, though I had no pretensions to either devotion or piety, I could certainly say that the Buddha had done wonderful things for me, and I hoped that they would no more question the genuineness of my experience than I questioned the genuineness of theirs. In any case, no open-minded person could fail to agree that there was an element of truth in every religion, and that no system of belief to which men and women had sincerely dedicated their lives could possibly be regarded as nothing but a mass of falsehood. This was very much the line of reasoning I had pursued with the priests and brothers of the Roman Catholic mission, especially Brother Peter, and on account of which, no doubt, Monsignor had forbidden them to associate with me. In the case of Miss Long and Miss Short, however, I pursued it much more vigorously and enlarged upon it to a much greater extent than I had done previously, for whereas it had been possible for me to disclose my views to the priests and brothers gradually in the course of a whole series of discussions, in the case of their less civilized Protestant counterparts, I had to disclose my views all at once in response to what was, in effect, a frontal attack on my most cherished convictions as a Buddhist and as a thinking human being. So vigorously, indeed, did I pursue my more ecumenical line, and to so great an extent did I enlarge upon it, that on the more intelligent and sensitive of my two visitors, at least, I eventually succeeded in making an impression. Not that Miss Long suddenly started doubting that Jesus had done wonderful things for her, but from the troubled, intent expression that appeared upon her pallid countenance, it was obvious that I had actually made her think, and that, for one awful, dizzying moment, she had even contemplated the possibility that there might be something in what I said. Miss Short was made of sterner stuff, or perhaps she was only more obtuse. So far as she was concerned, there could not be anything in what I or any other Buddhist monk said, and the question of contemplating, even for an instant, the possibility that there might be, simply did not arise. She had, however, wit enough to perceive that her friend had been somewhat disturbed by my words, and needed perhaps an opportunity of strengthening her faith by more searching of the scriptures and more waiting on the Lord in prayer. A signal having passed between them, she therefore looked at her watch and announced that it was time they departed, and a few minutes later, after bidding me a rather constrained farewell, the two would-be proselytizers descended the steps of the Shelley in a somewhat more chastened frame of mind than they had ascended them 2 hours earlier. What account of their visit they gave to the missionaries of their acquaintance I never knew, but they did not come to see me again, and whenever I happened to pass them in the high street, they did their best to pretend that they had not seen me. When this was impossible, Miss Long acknowledged my salutation with a look of mingled horror and reproach, as though I had brought her to the edge of the bottomless pit and had very nearly succeeded in pushing her in, while Miss Short gave me a grim smile and a barely perceptible nod. Nonetheless, despite their lack of success with me, and in my heart of hearts, I could not help feeling quite sorry for them, especially Miss Long, the missionary girls were as determined as ever to convert the heathen inhabitants of Kalimpong to Christianity, and apparently decided that if they were to make any real headway, they would have to learn Tibetan. What better way of learning Tibetan could there be than living with a respectable Tibetan family, and at the same time teaching the members of that family English, or at least giving them practice in English conversation? Indeed, what better way of spreading the gospel could there be? For like many other enthusiasts, Miss Long and Miss Short were convinced that except in the case of those who, like the English Buddhist monk, deliberately closed their hearts to the truth, their message only had to be heard to be believed. The only real difficulty lay in getting a hearing. A few months after their encounter with me, therefore, the missionary girls moved in with Mr. and Mrs. Shagabpa, an elderly couple who occupied the Western-style bungalow that they had built for themselves below the road at 9¼ mile, next door to the blind school. Sepon, or Treasurer Shagabpa, was a high official in the Tibetan government, who invariably wore Tibetan dress and a gold and turquoise ear pendant, and who, moreover, wore his long hair in braids coiled round his head, which gave him a curiously feminine look. I had known him virtually since my arrival in Kalimpong, and he had always been a generous supporter of the YMBA and Stepping Stones, though, since he knew little English and I less Tibetan, communication between us had perforce been limited to an exchange of friendly smiles. Mrs. Shagabpa, who knew no English at all, was a very large woman whose thick braids hung down to well below her rather high waist, and the greater part of whose person was covered by an enormous expanse of rainbow apron. Though she hardly ever spoke, Mrs. Shagabpa's rose-cheeked face was invariably creased in a beaming smile that appeared to betoken immense goodwill towards the whole world. With Mr. and Mrs. Shagabpa, then, Miss Long and Miss Short domesticated themselves, though in what capacity or on what terms was far from clear. The Tibetans of Kalimpong were convinced that one could not possibly learn Tibetan or any other subject properly without a teacher to hit you over the head with a ruler. Part of Joe's reputation as a teacher was due to the freedom with which he wielded that instrument of pedagogy. And still more convinced that no missionary could possibly succeed in converting a Tibetan, a real Tibetan, born and brought up in Tibet, not the mongrel Darjeeling or Ladakhi variety, from Buddhism to Christianity. What, then, was the missionary girl's real motive for living with Mr. and Mrs. Shagabpa? It was not long before the collective intelligence of the Tibetan community succeeded in coming up with a solution to this problem. For, as I already knew, the Tibetans were a logically minded people who firmly believed that there was a rational explanation for even the oddest behaviour and never rested until they had discovered it. The reason the two young English women had moved in with the Shagabpas was that they had their eye on Mr. Shagabpa, who was not only a high official but extremely wealthy. And they had their eye on him because they wanted to establish themselves in life by becoming his secondary wives or concubines, it being well known that Mrs. Shagabpa had so far borne him no child. The short, fat one, they collectively opined, would probably prove a good breeder, though they had their doubts about the tall, thin one. Poor Miss Long, poor Miss Short. If they had their eye on Mr. Shagabpa at all, it was only as a prospective convert, and had they known what the Tibetans were saying about them, they would undoubtedly have been both shocked and horrified. Yet, curiously enough, when I happened to call on Mr. Shagabpa a few months later, it was the frilly-aproned missionary girls who, under Mrs. Shagabpa's kindly superintendence, carried in the heavily laden tea trays and served tea, though without looking at me, for all the world as though they were concubines who were living in perfect harmony with both the master and the mistress of the house. After that, I did not meet them, as distinct from passing them in the high street, for several years, when I came upon them having tea with a Sikkimese Buddhist friend of mine and his European wife. By this time, Miss Long had got over her horror of me, though both women continued to think of Buddhism in terms of demonolatry and black magic. This was evident from a story which Miss Long related for the benefit of our hostess shortly after my arrival. She had happened to pass a group of Tibetans who were performing some kind of ceremony, and a leaf from the officiating lama's book — Tibetan books were, of course, made up of bundles of loose leaves — had suddenly blown across her path. Since nobody seemed to want it, she picked up the leaf and put it in her bag, intending to send it to her brother, who collected curios and was fond of such things. That night she had a most awful experience. A horrible, hairy monster climbed on top of her and did its best to strangle her. For what seemed like an eternity, she was unable to move or even to cry out. Eventually, she managed to find her voice and, with a supreme effort, ejaculated, "Jesus!" whereupon the monster fled. She awoke, if indeed she had been sleeping, and the first thing she did on getting up in the morning was to go to her bag, take out the accursed leaf from the lama's book with a pair of tongs, and burn it. "What do you think of that?" she exclaimed, turning to me with an air of triumph, as though she had conclusively demonstrated the diabolical nature of Buddhism in general, and Tibetan Buddhism in particular. "I don't know what I think," I replied, "but I know what Freud would have thought." Sallies of this kind did little to increase my popularity with Miss Long and Miss Short, any more than my vigorous pursuit of a more ecumenical line of reasoning had done when they visited me at the chalet. Indeed, shortly after that memorable visit, I gathered that the well-meaning young women had been so upset and angered by my stubborn refusal to accept Jesus as my personal saviour and be converted back to Christianity, that they had proceeded to give me an even worse name among the missionaries than I already possessed. Since it was at about this time that the missionaries started referring to me as the enemy of the church, I naturally suspected the missionary girls of having bestowed this sobriquet upon me, though the truth of the matter was that I was so unpopular, not to say infamous, with the missionaries that it could have originated with any one of them. Not that I minded being called the enemy of the church. On the contrary, I was proud of my new title, even though it did at the same time sadden me to think that any body of Christians could regard me as an enemy simply because I belonged to another religion. After all, I had done no harm to the missionaries or their work. I had not attacked Christianity publicly, much less still abused it in the vulgar and intemperate manner in which some of them abused Hinduism and Buddhism twice a week in the marketplace. All I had done was to live my own life as a Buddhist monk and explain Buddhism to those who were interested. But it was this that constituted my great offence. It was this that made me the enemy of the church. In fact, it was not even necessary for me actually to do anything or say anything. All I had to do was to be a Buddhist, and that I was a Buddhist, my shaven head and yellow robe sufficiently proclaimed. It was therefore not just a question of my presence in Kalimpong rather than Calcutta, or West Bengal rather than East Punjab. I was the enemy of the church simply by virtue of my existence, even though that existence happened to be more perceptible in Kalimpong than elsewhere, and constituted, therefore, a greater problem to the missionaries of that place. I had only to be seen walking through the bazaar, apparently, for doubts to arise in the minds of Nepalese converts to Christianity, and for the faith of Western-educated Buddhists to be strengthened. It was as though I was a living testimony to the fact that Christianity was not the only religion, that an alternative existed in the form of Buddhism, and that there were Westerners who, despite their being brought up as Christians, nonetheless chose to follow the Buddha rather than Christ, the Dharma rather than the Gospel. Thus, even without my intending it, my presence in Kalimpong had the effect of undermining the missionaries and their work to an even greater extent than Father Morse's presence had done. Father Morse's unwanted presence had only undermined their confidence in themselves as missionaries, whereas my own still more unwanted presence undermined their confidence in themselves as Christians. It was not surprising, therefore, that the missionaries should hate me even more, perhaps, than they hated Father Morse, or that they should start referring to me as the enemy of the church. I had, of course, good reason to be the enemy of the church, whether by simply existing or in a more active manner. Indeed, I had not been in enjoyment of my new title for many months, when, certain facts having come to my notice, I realised I had even more reason to be the enemy of the church than I had supposed. As I well knew, like their colleagues elsewhere in India, the missionaries of Kalimpong, both Protestant and Roman Catholic, were concerned to make as many converts as possible. I also knew that they were not over-scrupulous about how they made them, bribes, threats, and inducements all featuring among the methods of conversion, especially in the more outlying areas of the subdivision. But there was a method of conversion of which I had not as yet heard, a method even more unsavoury than the others, if that were possible, and it was coming to know about this method that made me realise I had even more reason to be the enemy of the church than I had supposed. I called the method conversion through pregnancy. At the beginning of September, when the rains were already abating and the sun shining forth, I learned from Lachiman in Dawa that three young men who were known to us were being subjected to tremendous pressure to become Christians. On my looking into the matter, it transpired that all three of them had had affairs with local Christian girls, and that when the girls had become pregnant, the authorities of the mission where they lived had insisted that the young men should marry them. But this was not all. The mission authorities had not only insisted that the young men should marry the girls, which in itself was not unreasonable, they had also insisted that the young men should marry the girls in church, and that, in order to be able to do this, they should become Christians. Only one of the young men, who happened to be the eldest son of the long-lived Deva, had had sufficient strength of mind not to succumb to the pressure that was brought to bear on him. He could not be sure, he declared, if the girl was really pregnant by him, since she was a girl of loose character and he was not the only young man in Kalimpong who had had to do with her. His two fellow culprits, or fellow victims, had, however, succumbed to the pressure exerted by the mission authorities, had agreed to marry their respective women, to marry them in church, and to become Christians. But one of them, at least, had reckoned without his mother. That short but formidable lady was not only a pious Buddhist, but, what was more to the point, the proprietress of Gompu's restaurant, a European-style establishment that stood a little apart from the other buildings at the far end of the high street. "He could become a Christian and marry the girl if he liked," she told her erring son. "But if he did so, he would cease to be a son of hers. She would disinherit him, and he would have no share in her property when she died." Pleasant, easygoing young Tashi Gompu was not long in making his choice. Like the youthful Edward Gibbon, he sighed as a lover, he obeyed as a son. Or rather, he gave in to the stronger of the two pressures and bought off the mission authorities by promising to contribute to the support of the child. This meant that, in the event, only one of the young men actually succumbed to the pressure exerted by the mission authorities and allowed himself to be married in accordance with Christian rites. Unlike the two who did not succumb, Dil Bahadur was neither Sikkimese nor Tibetan, but Nepalese, and not Buddhist, but Hindu. Moreover, unlike Karma Tsering, he had no strength of mind, and unlike Tashi Gompu, he had no formidable and well-to-do mother to exert any counter-pressure. He was, in fact, in a quite vulnerable position. For one thing, the girl he had made pregnant was a Lepcha Christian, which meant that the well-organised and influential Lepcha Association had taken up her case and threatened him with all sorts of dire consequences, including a beating up on a dark night, if he did not marry her. For another, he worked in the Kalimpong Arts and Crafts, which, like the Lepcha Association, was controlled by the Scottish Mission, with the result that he had also been threatened with the loss of his job if he refused to become a Christian and do the right thing by the girl. Dil Bahadur was, in fact, the same young decorator of lampshades and firescreens to whom Joe had become so strongly attached shortly after his arrival in Kalimpong, on whose account he had decided to settle in the township, and who had been living with him for the last 2 years. And the fact that his protege had now succumbed to the pressure exerted by the mission authorities, not to speak of his having succumbed to the wiles of a Lepcha Christian girl, was a source of ill-concealed mortification to the hypersensitive Upasaka, the more especially since he was not in a position to exert the kind of counter-pressure that Mrs. Gompu had exerted. For my part, I was not very much concerned with the precise nature of the threats made against Dil Bahadur, or with Joe's inability to prevent a development with which he was clearly unhappy. What interested me was the fact that, in the case of all three young men, there had occurred the same sequence of events. First had come the affair with the Christian girl, apparently with the approval, or at least the connivance, of the authorities of the mission where she lived. Then, when the girl had become pregnant, there had come the insistence of those same authorities that the young man should marry the girl, that he should marry her in church, that he should become a Christian. Moreover, this insistence had not been a matter of simple persuasion or exhortation, but of the systematic exertion of every kind of pressure, not excluding the threat of physical violence. Knowing as I did how eager the missionaries were for conversions, and how unscrupulous they could be in bringing them about, I therefore found it difficult to resist the conclusion that, acknowledged or unacknowledged, conversion by pregnancy was one of the numerous methods by which they sought to win souls for Christ and enlarge the boundaries of the kingdom. Something would have to be done to check the abuse. But what? I did not know. In any case, I was about to leave for Calcutta and had no time to give further thought to the matter. Perhaps my friends at the Mahabodhi Society would be able to advise me. End of chapter 17.